It's the morning show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Lake Michigan's waves outline 495 miles of Wisconsin's border. Researchers are using new strategies to monitor how the soil around the lake is eroding and where it goes. That's especially important now because erosion rates are increasing and the shoreline is declining. Be part of this conversation about the Great Lakes and erosion by calling in with your questions or ideas. The number is 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Luke Zoot. He's an associate professor in the Department of Geoscience at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He leads a research team studying bluff erosion and sediment movement. Luke, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks for having me, Keely.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're studying Lake Michigan shoreline erosion at two sites. One is south of Port Washington, and the other is Point Beach State Forest near Two Rivers. Why select these two sites?
Yeah, well, when you look at the shoreline of Wisconsin, it's composed largely of sort of these two end memory cases. One are these sort of coastal cliffs or bluffs that we call them, made up of sediment. And so this is sediment that was laid down by the glaciers and old large versions of the Lake Michigan. And those ring about 70% of the Wisconsin coastline. And then the other end member are these sort of beaches like you see at Point Beach State Park and things like that. And those are typically not backed by these cliffs. They have dunes behind them or dune grass and things like that. And when we go to these two sites, they kind of represent either side of the coin there. And so if we can figure out how these two areas are eroding, they kind of represent a pretty good template for how the other areas along Lake Michigan would erode, because by and large, they sort of fall into one of those two categories.
And the conditions at these two sites, are they fully, you know, representative of everything? Are we missing anything if we're looking at these two, or this covers the majority?
I would say this covers the majority, but we're not covering everything. So there's some places specifically up like Door County and things like that that have what we call rocky coastlines. And so in those areas, if you've ever been up there and you go up to the edge of the lake there, you can actually see bedrock exposed. And so this is really strong rock that the waves hit and try to erode, but it takes a lot longer. And so in these other areas, like in Point Beach and down south farther by Lion's Den, it's made up of literally just sediment or unconsolidated dirt, or is sort of the term we use, unconsolidated sediment. And in those areas, the wave erosion is particularly important can be particularly effective, because in the areas of the bluffs where you have the tall coastal cliffs, if the lake level changes a little bit, those waves make their way farther and farther up the beach, and they actually start to erode the toe of the bluff, or the part that is the lowest. And what happens is when you erode that toe, the whole bluff starts to get steeper and steeper and steeper. And if it gets steeper and steeper, the sediment can't hold that slope. And so it has small landslides and other types of failures to reduce the slope. And in that process, sediment is carried from on the bluff down into the water. And once it's in the water, the waves sifted and winnow it and things like that, and they sort out the sand particles in particular. And that's what goes into building the beaches. And so it's estimated that in a place like Wisconsin, that almost 100% of the sand on the beach came from those bluffs. And so that erosion of the bluffs and of the dunes in the area is the most important source for supplying the sand to keep the beaches stable also. And so there's this sort of a relationship between what happens with the erosion of the bluffs and then the presence or the stability of the beaches in the area.
So it's a balance. I could see somebody hearing that explanation and thinking, okay, so we'll get, you know, more beaches, more robust beaches in Wisconsin. That sounds like a great deal. Tell us why it's not so simple at face value.
Yeah, because a lot of the times people have built their houses, structures have been built on the top of these bluffs. And so while it's a natural process that the bluffs and the coastline changes dynamically, we built a lot of structures around them. And so it would be a good deal if we had no, you know, permanent structures around these areas. But the fact that we do means that slowly people's property gets cut into, it gets reduced. And in some instances, if the houses are close enough to the bluff edge, they can actually fall in. And that can be quite costly, but and sometimes it can actually be quite surprising for people. I think that sometimes people may not realize that these bluffs retreat as quickly as they do, and that maybe some of their property is as vulnerable as it is, you know. And so people have bought houses on these things and seen really rapid retreats in their property over short periods of time. And that's because, you know, when we monitor and watch this erosion along the coastline, it doesn't occur sort of continuously. It occurs at different rates at different times. And so you may experience very little erosion for 20 years or so. And then as the lake level goes up, you may experience much more erosion or a lot of erosion in a relatively short period of time, which could surprise you because maybe you've been living in the house for 15 years and you haven't seen that before. And so it's dangerous to properties that are on top. In some areas, like at Lion's Den, there's a park there and there's lots of hiking trails and stuff like that right near the crest of the edge. And so as the bluff recedes and gets closer to those hiking trails, you know, people are closer to this relatively big cliff that's fairly steep, and it, you know, poses a risk for people sort of slipping off the edge or getting too close to the edge and things like that. And so while it's a natural cycle and it's good for stabilizing the beaches, it's also bad for maybe property owners that live there or public commissions that own the land itself.
We're talking about erosion control along Lake Michigan with researcher Luke Zoot. Your questions and comments welcome at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your experiences or ask Luke your question. You mentioned that people may not see changes for a very long time and then suddenly things change. You've been studying bluff and sand dune erosion at these particular two sites in Wisconsin since 2016. How urgent is it that we get this better understanding of erosion that's happening in the Great Lakes?
I think it's pretty vital. You know, the Great Lakes are interesting in the sense that if you look at the water level of them, they fluctuate. And in particular, Lake Michigan, it goes up and down, and it can go up and down by sort of as much as 3 years on a multi-year time scale, on sort of a decadal time scale. And while that may not seem like a lot, if you think about it, if you've been out to the beach, the slope of the beaches are often quite low. So they're sort of like 1 to 100, which means if you walked up the beach 100 feet, you would be 1 foot higher. But that also means if the water level goes up a foot, you've now lost that 100 feet of beach. And so if the water level goes up 3 feet and the slope is 1 to 100, you've now lost 300 feet of beach. And in some areas, they don't have that 300 feet of beach available. And so that's when the waves start attacking the toes of the bluffs. And so, what we've seen is since 2013 to about 2020, the water level in Lake Michigan rose steadily, and it rose a lot, and it kept rising and rising and rising. And as it did that, we lost more and more beach, and those waves were able to attack the bluffs. Now, since then, it's receded, but we're still feeling the effects of that rise and that erosion that occurred at the toes of those bluffs, because it takes some time for that erosion activity to work its way up to the top. And so, in some areas, we didn't necessarily even feel the erosion that was occurring at the bottom until now. And so, we want to learn about what is that time scale? How long does it take for that erosion to make its way to the top? And how much erosion might we expect at the top so that we can give counties and city planners and private residents and things like that an estimate of time where, you know, they can expect these effects to still be felt at the top. And largely that sort of scales with how tall the bluffs are and things of that nature. The other thing that's happened is we've seen fairly recently in the 2020, you know, nearly the highest water level that Lake Michigan's ever been at. And then it dropped again. But if it comes back up again, we could have these sorts of problems in the future again, as sort of erosion is continued and exacerbated as water level reaches, you know, near high levels again. The other thing that happens a lot in the Great Lakes, in particular, compared to a lot of other coastlines like on the ocean, is we have this season called winter in Wisconsin, you know, that we're all familiar with. And as we have winter, that process of freezing things up makes things behave quite a bit more differently in Wisconsin and Michigan and things like that than it ever would in a place like North Carolina. We get lake ice that forms on the coastline. that lake ice is sort of in some ways a double-edged sword. One of my PhD students, Chelsea Volpano, is working on these effects. And as the lake ice forms, it can protect some parts of the beach, but it can make other parts of the beach more vulnerable to being eroded. In addition, when we get these cold temperatures, the bluffs in themselves, the sediment in them, lots of times are saturated with water, and that water freezes solid. And that actually helps to strengthen the bluff. But what happens is, as spring rolls around, the bluffs are fairly out of balance from being frozen solid all winter, but still having waves erode their toe. And when the spring happens and they thaw out, the whole bluffs can tend to slump. And you can get huge slumping failures in the early spring and in the springtime in particular. People that live around these bluffs have probably noticed the seasonality to them. And so a student of mine, Colin Rowland, is also working on this project. And as we start to change the winter conditions here, maybe winter lake ice comes and goes, or the winter changes, we're going to change the seasonality that's imposed on these bluffs by the formation of lake ice and ice freezing in the bluff itself. And so we're trying to get a grasp on all these processes and how they're all linked together and try to look at them holistically. Right now, while we kind of have the situation where the bluffs are changing and we can go out there and measure things real rapidly with series of drones and other types of instruments that we've been putting out, little boats that we drive around in the lake itself that measure the lake bottom, things like
Yeah,
that.
let's talk about that in just a moment. We've got Luke Zoot, who studies bluff erosion along Lake Michigan, with us. We are welcoming your experiences and taking your questions as the conversation continues. Call 800-642-1234. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. Scientists are studying what's happening when it comes to erosion on Lake Michigan's shoreline, and we're taking your questions at 800-642-1234. We are talking with a lead researcher, Luke Zoot, who is our guest. His team studies bluff erosion and sediment movement along Lake Michigan. And Luke, your team is using an uncommon technique to study this erosion. You've got researchers wading into the water to survey the sediment. Why are you using this method?
Yeah, so one thing we want to do for this project in particular is connect the onshore bluff erosion to the offshore change in the lake bed. And we have these boats that can go out into the water and measure the lake bed with this instrument. But the problem is, these boats are really good, but they can only get up to about 3 feet of water. And then we can do the onshore portion with drones that can map it. But we're left with this gap where basically from the water line to where the water is about 3 feet deep. And so that part is particularly tricky. And so the way we do it is sort of old fashioned. We literally have a stick with a GPS mounted on it, and we wade out into the water until about 3 feet. And by doing that, we can measure the depth to the lake bottom, or bathymetry that we call it. And we can connect the offshore bathymetry that we're collecting from the boat with the onshore bathymetry with a drone. Now, it seems great because a lot of us go to the winter or go to the beach in the middle of the summer, but we often need to collect this data up through the winter. And so my grad student, Chelsea Volpano, has been out in Lake Michigan in insulated waters when it's right around freezing, catching this stuff, or measuring this lake bottom bathymetry in conditions that, aren't the funnest, but we need to do it to be able to connect the different surveys that we're doing.
Yeah, that certainly takes some commitment. We are taking calls at 800-642-1234, and we have Grant in Douglas County who's ready to join the conversation. Hey, Grant.
Hi. I live along in Douglas County along Lake Superior, and there's primarily red clay banks along this end of Lake Superior. And I was just wondering if your guests could speak about any lake levels or knowledge about erosion along the South Shore.
Sounds great. Thank you so much, Grant. Luke, what about the clay banks and erosion?
Yeah, so up in Douglas County, the shoreline there is actually outlined with the Douglas member of the of till. So that's actually a glacial sediment that's in place there that was put in place by Lake Superior low when the Lake Superior Basin was full of ice. I was actually up there 2 weeks ago looking at it. And that sediment is interesting because it's so fine grained that the fine grained material, basically what happens is when it rains, it doesn't want to let the water through. And so sometimes if you get really big changes in the water table, that area can become particularly unstable. It also means that there's not a lot of sand. There's not a lot of sand layers in those areas, and a lot of times when we see sand layers mixed in with the red clays, the sands act as sort of a pipe to pipe the water through. And without those, there's sort of limited option for where it can go. And so you've probably seen as you walk around the shoreline there, when that gets wet, it feels real soupy, real feels real mucky, and you sort of like your feet get stuck in it. It gets stuck on everything. And so when that sediment gets fully saturated, it doesn't have a lot of strength to it, and it can erode away. And much like Lake Michigan, Lake Superior has been going through these lake level fluctuations. And as it goes up, you lose your beach. The coastline up there, up by the counties on the south shore of Lake Superior, are also ringed by these bluffs in lots of instances, and those bluffs erode the same way. And so the processes that we're studying down here are pretty applicable to the things that are going up on Lake Superior, because you have the same things. You have winter, you have these glaciers that put these big piles of sediment that the lake is currently eroding into. The exact specifics are a little different from place to place, but there are things that we can measure. Like we can get a grab of that sediment that's up in Douglas County, and we could take it back into my lab at UW-Madison, and we can measure the what we call the engineering properties of that material. We can measure the frictional strength of it. We can measure things like how it allows water to move through it. And when we know that, and we know the general processes that we've learned from these other sites, we can get a pretty good estimate of where things are going to fail and where things are going to be relatively stable going into the future.
We're talking about shoreline erosion with UW-Madison Geoscience Associate Professor Luke Zoot, and we're particularly focused on Lake Michigan, but also took a quick trip up to Lake Superior. Luke, you're studying which types of vegetation grow along the shoreline and if those can prevent erosion. And you're doing this with drones. What do you hope to gather using those drones that maybe you can't get using other methods?
Yeah, so a new project that we're hoping to do is to examine specifically the vegetation. And so all the previous work I've been talking about has been funded by the Wisconsin Sea Grant. But we have a new project coming up that's kind of a pilot project because it's sort of new, funded by the Wisconsin Coastal Management Program, to look specifically at vegetation. And so if you ever dug in your garden or anything, you know that plants have these roots, right? And these roots extend some depth into the soil. Well, those roots actually help to stabilize the area, right? They basically bind all the sediment together, and they kind of make it harder for landslides to occur. They make it hard for water that's moving over the surface to move the soil around. And so what we want to look at is if there's certain types of vegetation that can help stabilize these areas as opposed to other types of vegetations. And so to do that, we're using drones. And so I'm working with a colleague of mine in the geography department at UW-Madison, Christian Andreessen, and he's kind of a drone vegetation expert. So he uses drones to map out types of vegetation that there is in the Arctic. And I sort of talked him into applying this to these bluffs here in Wisconsin. And we did a pilot run in Port Washington a couple of last summer that went really well, and now we're going to extend it going forward. And from using the drone data, he can basically look at the colors, and he can look at this thickness of the canopy, he calls it basically. So is it vegetation that has woody stems? Is it sort of more like grassy? And then we can correlate the areas that are stable with the types of vegetation that is on them. And so if all things are equal and you see an area that's relatively stable and it's got lots of one particular type of vegetation or one collection of vegetation, it's a good bet that that type of vegetation has the right root system for these types of sediments, these tills, these lake sediments and things like that, to help stabilize the bluff and potentially reduce some of these erosive effects. And so the whole point is to use this Ozaukee County as sort of a prototype to see if we can to try to figure this out.
Luke, I know your research goes much deeper, and we are out of time for this conversation. Hope to talk to you again in the future. Thank you so much for breaking it down for us, and best of luck.
Well, thank you very much, Keely. It was great.
Absolutely. Luke Zoot is an associate professor in the Department of Geoscience at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He leads a research team studying bluff erosion and sediment movement. Rates of erosion on Lake Michigan hit near record levels in 2020. Scientists are working to better understand why that's happening and how erosion on the Great Lakes compares to other environments. Thanks for joining us on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. The number of elderly Americans behind bars has skyrocketed in recent decades, and costs are climbing for prisons as they deal with more advanced medical needs. As Sarah Lear reports, in Wisconsin, that's led to the Department of Corrections opening a different kind of prison ward.
Oku Correctional is a minimum security facility surrounded by cornfields just outside Madison. Most of the inmates there sleep in bunk beds, but as nursing supervisor Rachel Snow explains, at a newly opened unit within Oak Hill, all the beds are low to the ground.
There's many of the guys that are down there that cannot navigate steps.
Wisconsin's Department of Corrections opened the assisted living facility earlier this year. On a recent summer day, the unit is busy with more than 20 inmates. Some use wheelchairs or walkers. Another does an exercise with a nurse intended to improve range of motion in his arm. Many of the men there need help with showering, dressing, or eating. And Snow says a lot of them have chronic conditions.
Respiratory issues, end-stage COPD, emphysema, cardiac issues.
There are more than 20,000 people locked up in Wisconsin prisons, and more than 15% are over age 55. That percentage has more than tripled over the last two decades.
As our incarcerated population ages, we will see a greater need.
The graying of Wisconsin's prison population mirrors national trends. Experts say that's partly because the country's population is getting older on average. But Mike Wessler, who advocates for reducing the incarcerated population through the Prison Policy Initiative, says it's also due to longer prison sentences.
In the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, there was a real focus on kind of tough on crime policies that ushered in an era of mass incarceration.
Harlan Richards was 30 when he was convicted of murder after stabbing someone in a fight. He served decades behind bars in Wisconsin before he was paroled at age 67. He says prison life is different for older inmates.
Yeah, I mean, you get aches and pains, and you get medical problems, and a young guy can stand sleeping on a hard bed. He can stand, you know, the substandard food and stuff like that.
Increasingly, prison systems are responding to the needs of older inmates with specialized facilities. A federal prison in Massachusetts has a memory disorder unit to treat dementia. At a special needs prison in Nashville, inmates can be admitted to units with assisted living or nursing care. Bryce Peterson is a scientist with the CNA Center for Justice Research and Innovation. He says many people enter prison in worse health than the general public, in part because of poverty. Then, medical problems can get even worse because of the conditions within prison, including violence and poor health care.
Their physiological age is actually 10 to 15 years older than what their age actually is.
Peterson says that all has financial consequences.
The best estimates are that it's anywhere from 2 to 5 times more to take care of someone who's older than it is to take care of someone who's younger in prison.
At the same time, studies show the chance of people reoffending decreases with age. Every state except for Iowa has what's known as compassionate release policies. Those allow inmates to get out early because of advanced age or serious health problems. But Wessler, the Prison Policy Initiative spokesman, says compassionate release is rarely used.
It's a cumbersome process. It requires lots of approvals, lots of documentation.
Last year, Wisconsin granted compassionate release to 5 prisoners. Many inmates in the state are not eligible for the program, including people convicted of serious felonies and anyone who committed a crime before the year 2000. Wessler hopes for a more far-reaching solution.
My hope is that before prisons consider opening a nursing home behind bars, states will look at revisiting some of these harsh sentencing laws.
He and other advocates say the focus should be on reducing the incarcerated population to begin with. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. Our next guest is Katina DeJarnette. You may know her as Katina Eats Kilos. She is a professional eater, a YouTuber, and a former bodybuilder. She lives in Milwaukee, and she's ready to talk with us about food challenges. Katina, thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Keely. Thank you for having me on.
You travel the globe completing food competitions. You were recently in New Zealand and just got back to Wisconsin from a European tour. What is the appeal of professional eating beyond the fact that apparently it can take you around the world?
You also get to meet a lot of really interesting people. So it's a really good time. You get to meet really cool restaurant owners, try unique foods around the world, of course, and then, of course, meet some of the viewers as well. If you don't know, I have a YouTube channel, and that's kind of what started the whole traveling around the world part, having the YouTube channel and just making content and videos. And then from there, we are able to go around and visit different restaurants, meet some of our subscribers that are on YouTube or Facebook, TikTok, Snapchat, et cetera, and really connect with those people on a personal level. So it's all a good time.
And I understand in Belgium, you participated in an eating challenge at a fast food taco place?
Yeah, sort of. It's called Otacos, but they don't really serve tacos as we know them. It's more like a really glorified burrito, kind of like a California burrito in a way. But yeah, we did an event at a fast food joint, Otacos, and we were like thinking, oh, maybe we'll have a few people. This might get a little bit crowded in here. And it turned out that I would say like 3 or 4 dozen people showed up into this like tiny little space. And it was really, really hectic, but amazing, amazing to see that support. It was super humbling that people all the way in Belgium were watching my videos along with my partner, my boyfriend, Randy Santel's videos as well, all the way in Belgium. So that was definitely really humbling.
Eating California taco style tacos in Belgium for a food competition. This is great stuff.
Yeah.
We are taking your questions on professional eating as we talk with Katina DeJarnette. You can call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Speaking of videos, Katina, one of your most popular videos is the Wisconsin Biggest Breakfast Challenge. That video has nearly 4 million views on YouTube. What was on your plate?
Oh, it was everything. What wasn't on that plate? I know there were all sorts of different kinds of sausages. There were eggs, hash browns. I believe there was like biscuits and gravy. There was pancakes, bacon. I believe there was like a chicken fried steak or something. I mean, it was wild. There was so much going on that platter. And we were kind of briefed beforehand because this was like a new challenge that this would come in at right around 5 or so pounds. And it certainly came in quite a bit bigger than that. It was, I would say, pretty close to 8 pounds. So that one was quite the doozy to start a morning with.
Yeah. And to do it in 45 minutes, what is your strategy for eating that amount of food in such a short amount of time?
Oh, be really, really hungry. Luckily, I was pretty hungry. Breakfast is my favorite meal of the day. So all of my favorite things were on that platter. And I guess just kind of pack it all in as much as possible. But of course, that kind of comes with training, practicing a lot, and stretching the stomach beforehand to be prepared for the challenge.
And you consider yourself a professional eater, not a competitive eater. What is the distinction you draw?
Yeah, that's actually a really good one. I get that a lot of people saying that I'm a competitive eater. But what I would say is a competitive eater is someone who goes up on like a stage and competes against other people. So my favorite example of this is if you know that on the 4th of July, there's the famous Nathan's hot dog eating contest in New York. That is competitive eating, where you're up on a stage, you have like 10 minutes to scoff down as much food as possible, and you're trying to beat everyone else up on the stage. Whereas I would consider professional eating to be someone who is kind of like you versus the restaurant, or a man versus food, kind of like that really famous TV show with Adam Richman, or now Casey Webb. But yeah, so it's basically me versus the food while also sort of being me promoting the restaurant or at least giving some feedback on what I think about the restaurant, which is generally overall positive.
We've got Jack from Madison on the line ready to talk with you this morning. Hey, Jack.
Good morning.
What are you curious about?
Well, I just want to ask you, yes, like how does one get into this? How did she get her start? And I guess, what is it about food and eating contests? And I guess more so sort of the diner versus restaurant thing as she described it, or kind of like TikTok eating challenges. Like, how do you get into that? And like what got her started on all this?
Great question, Jack. Thank you so much. Katina.
Yeah, that was a solid question, Jack. Thank you. I actually got started with all of this back in 2019. I was a bodybuilder and training for a bodybuilding show, a women's physique bodybuilding show. And so I had to diet pretty hard to get into that show. Of course, you're kind of getting to a level of lean that is not typical. So while I was dieting for the show, I was really, really hungry. And I started to watch kind of videos on YouTube about eating just to kind of satisfy my hunger. I noticed that it kind of helped me feel a little bit less hungry while I was dieting. And kind of down the rabbit hole of YouTube, I started to discover competitive eating or professional eating where people were going around trying restaurant challenges or just building big food challenges at home. And I found that really entertaining. I was like, wow, I think that's something I could do. I've always had a really big appetite, even as a little girl. One of my dad's favorite stories is that when I was a little girl, we went to a famous fast food joint called Rally's. And I ate like a double cheeseburger, a side of fries, and then asked for more before my dad had finished his burger. And so once my bodybuilding show was over, I needed a good excuse to put on some weight again. And so I grabbed a little cheap camcorder, tried a local kind of smaller food challenge to get started. And I wanted dessert afterwards. I was really hungry, really good at it, got the win. And then I just continued bringing a camcorder around, recording bigger and bigger food challenges. And it's just sort of stuck. And I was really into it. And very shortly after, it became a career.
We've got YouTuber, professional eater, Milwaukee resident, Katina DeJarnett, staying with us here, taking your questions at 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking about eating challenges and how to put away massive meals in competition while also trying to lead a healthy life. We've got professional eater Katina DeJarnett with us, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Greg from Madison is ready to join our conversation. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. Good morning, Katina. I have a couple questions real quick for you. I got turned on to your YouTube channel. I don't know why it YouTube gave me who knows why YouTube does things, but in any event, I saw your Texas steak challenge. You ate this big old 96er steak anyways. So it's interesting you brought up the man versus food, because when I saw that video, and I've seen obviously your other videos or some of them, I'm like, this gal would be perfect for woman versus food. I'm wondering, has Food Network reached out to you, or maybe you should reach out to them? And then the second question is, how do you maintain a healthy body weight?
Yeah, Greg, thank you so much. Katina, what about, any major plans that you'd like to announce on Wisconsin Public Radio this morning about some sort of, you know, show focused on you on television?
First of all, thank you very much for a great question, Greg. I really appreciate that. But no, unfortunately not. I've been reached out by a few kind of smaller networks about maybe doing a show, but all of the plans have sort of fallen through. I think, unfortunately, the kind of man versus food concept is slowly dying. So I think it's kind of alive and well on YouTube, but long form content. And I think kind of, as we all know, TV is kind of slowly going out of style as well, as we have a 1 minute attention span now due to TikTok. So I think that that's probably a leading cause of that. But to answer part two of your question, Greg, while we're abroad, there wasn't a lot of opportunity to necessarily exercise formally. I love getting in the gym, throwing around some weights, getting some good training in. But while abroad, that opportunity wasn't really presented to us. Mostly we stayed fit by walking a lot, doing some sightseeing, and maybe at the most I would knock out some push-ups, sit-ups, and maybe some air squats or something. So mostly it was all down to nutrition. And of course, abroad, I enjoyed myself on my off days as well. I drank a lot, probably ate some really good food, good street food. But when possible, when I was feeling strong morally, I would try and diet. And so say I'd do two food challenges a week, that would leave me the rest of the days to basically put myself in a calorie deficit or to just eat less food in general. And those food choices that I made usually were geared towards giving me enough energy to be really, really active throughout the day and other things. So I'd say that that's probably the most simple answer. While I'm home, I'm able to really structure my diet, really focus in. I kind of become a little bit antisocial because I focus only on the gym, only on eating correctly. And that seems to work really well while home.
So it sounds like it's, again, about balance, Katina.
It really is. Yeah. Yeah. And I like to look at kind of a lot of people look at daily calories and then they get really upset with themselves if they kind of go off the rails on a Saturday and then they kind of quit their diet. Oh, I failed on Saturday. So tomorrow I might as well eat that bag of Oreos, which sounds amazing. It does, but it doesn't really help you with your goals. So really that checks and balances there of, you know, maybe you did get a little naughty on Saturday and you ate, you know, a box of pizza with your friends. But the next day you have every opportunity to get right back on track, eat according to whatever your nutrition goals are, and maybe get in some exercise and maybe use that box of pizza to get a little bit extra exercise in because you probably have some pretty good energy. So yeah, that would be my encouragement to everyone is that you can always balance your lifestyle, balance your diet.
Greg, thank you so much for those questions. We are taking calls at 800-642-1234. We're talking with professional eater Katina DeJarnette, known as Katina Eats Kilos. And it's fair to acknowledge you have let us know you are 5'2" tall. And yet one of your proudest food challenges is eating at Crawdaddy's in Greenfield, Wisconsin, which included something that was 5 foot long.
Yeah, it was a 5 foot long po' boy. And it was basically like five different sections of their famous po' boys that they serve there. All this kind of like, if you don't know what a po' boy is, it's kind of like a New Orleans kind of Cajun style, like toasted sub would be a really good simplified way to explain it. So I believe one section was like gator tail, like deep fried. I think there was like a shrimp, blackened halibut or cod or something like that, and a couple other things. And I had 1 hour to eat something that was only 2 inches shy of myself. And I went into that thinking, I am definitely going to lose, but I will put on one heck of a show. And with about 5 minutes to go on the time limit, I thought to myself, wow, I think I might actually get this. And so with every ounce of self-control and effort, I ended up pulling through with a win in 59 minutes and 59 seconds to make basically the old hometown proud. So yeah, that was definitely one of the greatest food challenge victory moments for me.
You finished with 1 second to spare.
One second to spare. And I mean, even if I had fumbled with my timer, that would have technically been a loss. No one's going to believe you if you don't hit your timer on time, you know? So there was a lot going into that. I was nervous. My hands were shaking, but we got it.
And you have to time yourself?
You can. I like to time myself so that I can have my timer facing the camera so that on video, you can see that there's no like crazy tricks going on. Sometimes towards the end of the challenge, I'll turn the timer towards me so that I am aware of how much time I have left. But typically, yeah, I like to show the timer off to the audience instead of putting a digital timer or just kind of having everyone guess where I'm at in a challenge.
You won that challenge by 1 second. But what can you learn from, you know, losing a food challenge?
Oh, a lot. You can learn a lot. So some of the stuff that you think would be easy or challenges that look easy on paper can be some of the toughest ones. There's a lot of times when restaurants get really excited for us to go and show up and to take part in their challenge. And one of the downsides of that is that they like to make their challenges look extra impressive. And by looking extra impressive, that also means that there's extra food compared to what is normally involved in a food challenge. And so we'll go into a challenge thinking, oh, this is going to be a really cool, easy 4 to 5 pound challenge. And we'll get there and maybe it's closer to 6, maybe even 6.5, 7 pounds. And it makes for a real rough day in the office. But that's basically the lesson from that is take nothing for granted, always show up trained, always ready to take on the biggest, baddest challenge yet. Never show up thinking it's going to be an easy day in the office.
Your website says you enjoy showcasing food or services at small restaurants. What's your business relationship with these places?
There are every now and then some occasions where restaurants will invite us out to not only promote like their restaurant, but also to like kick off a new challenge. And so that can be like a really cool thing where it's kind of like I scratch your back, you scratch mine. Not only are we kind of helping them kick off a challenge, they're kind of creating entertainment for us because, of course, food challenges are few and far between, especially nowadays. I think the peak of food and restaurant challenges was probably during the run of the Man versus Food TV show. And now, of course, after COVID as well, there's less and less. So when restaurants reach out and want to kick off a new challenge, that gives us another opportunity, another episode, another moment to be able to entertain folks, host events, invite people out to come cheer us on, et cetera. So a lot of times we host events, at these restaurants as well, which brings in a whole bunch of customers. And usually they order drinks or they order food while they're watching us take these challenges on. And so I think that's a really great opportunity for the restaurants as well.
Let's say I'm looking to get into professional eating or competitive eating. What food should I avoid?
Ooh, I don't know that there's anything that you would necessarily need to avoid. I would say the best method to getting started with food challenges, if you want to, which I would say it's a deep, dark rabbit hole to go down.
But, it's a niche area.
I would say it is. It's very niche. But you would probably want to start with something really, really small. Typically, kind of a good rule of thumb is if you have to pay for the meal, win or lose, at a restaurant, it's probably going to be a little bit on the easy side, a little bit easier than normal. So then there's oftentimes challenges that are around the 3 pound ballpark where you have to maybe eat a little bit quicker, but it doesn't involve a lot. So I'd say if you are able to eat aggressively with enjoyment, starting with a smaller challenge that maybe has a fast time limit would be a good a method to start. But also to just remember safety first, winning is not worth choking over or something. Chew your food thoroughly, at least have a buddy around to watch you do a food challenge for your first time because nerves can add up. You can do silly things. I know that if you go out and you think, oh, I've eaten my whole life, eating food quickly will be no problem. Wait until you get nervous. Don't forget that you know how to eat.
Katina, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much, Keely. Really appreciate you.
Katina DeJarnette, known as Katina Eats Kilos, is a professional eater, YouTuber, and former bodybuilder. She lives in Milwaukee. I'm Keely Boltina. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.